Rational discussion, common sense, open debate. RCR, Reality Check Radio with Paul Brennan.
Who and what are the Disinformation Project? You've heard them being mentioned, I'm sure. You might have even heard some names bandied around associated with this group. Where did they come from? What is their mission? Who funds them? Phil Shaw is from Operation People. His background is in military, SAS, Special Forces. He's an academic as well, and he's great at finding information, and he does that as part of Operation People. Nice to see you, or to hear from you, Phil, and thanks for making a bit of time for us on Reality Check.
Yeah, no, thanks for allowing me to come on and have a chat about some of my research.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I can't wait to get into it. But I think there's a few things that maybe we just have to hear about first. So as you're explaining all this, it kind of all falls together. People are probably going to hear this term critical theory as you're talking, I'm assuming.
Yes.
So, and I've heard of critical race theory, and I guess it's all related. We'll find out. But what does this term critical theory mean, and how does it apply, just quickly, briefly, to the individuals that we're going to be talking about?
So critical theory is sort of an ideology or a school of thought that's come out of America. And what it does is it seeks to reinterpret everything in a sort of class struggle system. So it has elements of Marxism, but it has sort of removed from the traditional form of Marxism. And that's where that intersectionality component comes in. So it forms a class struggle, and it looks for every single way that an individual could be either deemed as an oppressor or oppressed. So critical theory sort of concerns itself with identifying that. Within critical theory, they definitely have their own language. So you'll hear terms like white privilege and white supremacy and all of these things that are thrown around. They don't necessarily mean what you would assume them to mean.
So is that an evolution of classic Marxism? Because it sounds like it's a lot more fragmented potentially.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot more fragmented. And I guess some people have described it as sort of neo-Marxism or cultural Marxism, because it's reframed the traditional Marxism, which was Marxism was a class struggle, but on the economic sort of spectrum. So it was what they called the proletariat, or your working class, versus the bourgeoisie, who were the capitalist sort of landowner class. And Marx's sort of ideas were the proletariat needed to rise up in a dictatorship of the proletariat and overthrow the capitalist class so that they would own the means of production. And so it's very revolutionary. It's very much...
Right. And simple.
And simple, yeah. Yeah, quite simple. So critical theory just has essentially taken that basic concept and it applies it to power structures within society. And it's what they deem as power structures. And that's where we get the idea of intersectionality, which is you can divide society up into as many ways as you want on the basis of power struggles. And what they'll do is they'll use that intersectionality to then say, well, this person is essentially a victim on this level.
The word critical, everyone understands. What's the meaning of that word in that title, critical theory?
Well, it's actually distinctly different from what we would typically know critical to be, which would be critical thinking, which is essentially critical thinking would be taking both sides of an argument and evaluating the pros and cons on that argument to kind of get to the bottom of it. So that would be sort of the classical way of thinking about the term critical in critical thinking. How it's applied in critical theory is more of a critical consciousness. And so it's about evaluating your life in terms of that power struggle and figuring out where you are on the power struggle and becoming aware of that or conscious of your role that you play in the power struggle.
And once you've done that, where are you at? You've become critically conscious. Is that, and that could be at any level, I suppose. It depends on where you are on the measure, on the ladder. But once you've achieved critical consciousness, where does that leave someone in this?
So once you've achieved critical consciousness, I guess you've submitted to the ideology. So you've fully taken on the ideology, and now you, because you've submitted to it, now you become sort of a proponent of the ideology. You then join the movement, so to speak. Without the critical consciousness, if you don't have the critical consciousness, it actually becomes a symptom of the fact that you don't understand the movement.
Does that get you? Is that like a get out of jail card? Suddenly, you're not an oppressor anymore because you've hit this critical consciousness level. So you've sort of thrown off the.
Not exactly. So you still become an oppressor, but you're kind of a tolerated oppressor because you're still in that oppressor class. However, you've acknowledged the fact of your sort of oppressor history, and you sort of become, because of your critical awareness or your critical consciousness, you sort of become tolerated because you're now part of the movement. So you never actually stop being the oppressor because you're in this continual cycle of apologizing for that oppression, for your levels of oppression, but you will join that movement, and you will get sort of elevated in some levels within the movement because you've acknowledged your levels of oppression
despite your privilege. Okay, well, that's good to understand. So you've been on quite an information gathering operation. It's something that you know how to do with your background, and you might want to tell us about that. Up to you. Well, what set you out on this mission? Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I guess I wasn't overly political in my background. So my background's military. I spent 8 years in the army, and I sort of went through the army system, and my goal was to get into special forces. So I did that. And then after that, I went and studied medical laboratory science. And
interesting combination.
Yeah, it is. So one of my roles in special forces was a patrol medic, which meant that I sort of picked up medical skills, and that really introduced me to the medical field. And that's how I sort of got an interest in that. So yeah, as a side note, I sort of, once I left the army, I sort of became a bit more aware politically about what was happening in society. And I kind of thought to myself, what would happen if I was just in society, just chugging along, completely naive and ignorant of what was happening, and I was still in the military. And I thought, actually, you know, and in my role as special forces, I thought actually I could be used for some fairly dark sort of action without my knowing it. And so I thought actually I should, especially in a role like that, I should be very aware politically to make sure it aligns with sort of my conscience.
Could you explain that just a little bit more? I mean, you don't have to, but that has me interested. What?
Well, for instance, if you look back at sort of some of the tyrannical governments in the past, especially sort of Nazi Germany and things like that, most of the population were just swept up and went along with it. And so statistically, even though now looking back at it in hindsight, it's a beautiful thing, we would look back at it and say, oh, I wouldn't have been one of those people. But if you weren't aware politically of what was going on and asked yourself the question, hey, do I agree with this? Then you could very easily be swept up in the movement that everyone else is in. And so when I sort of evaluated my career goals of going for special forces, I was, you know, laser focused on achieving that goal. And so when I evaluate that and I go, you know, I was not politically aware at all. My politics when I was in the military were sort of, you know, I would vote blue because I liked the idea of business. And that was about the level of my politics. I didn't get into it. I didn't care. I didn't, you know, and that was it. So it was a very shallow understanding. And then when I got out and I sort of started to read more and learn more of the recent history, then I thought, actually, I better be you know, I better wake up and be careful that I just don't go with the political party just because everyone else does. And that led me to sort of ask the question, well, if I had done that statistically in somewhere like Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia or something like that, you know, I would have ended up going for that career goal, which was sort of the elite of the military.
And one of the shock troops.
Yeah, something like that. And I would have been, I would have gone with an ideology that I just totally wouldn't have agreed with morally. And so I thought, actually, I should be very much more morally aware of politics and where these political ideas are going, and make sure that I'm happy with that. And that sort of made me wake up, I guess you could say, you know, it made me wake up politically, as to be a lot more careful about evaluating political policies and things like that.
Wow, that's really interesting. Thanks for telling us about that. Okay, you mentioned you focused like a laser beam. So you've taken all those smarts and I guess you've got to be very resilient, very tough to hang in right to the end in that business. So you take that and you apply it to drilling for information. I would like you coming after all my information. I don't think there's probably anything I could hide because the determination would be there. So who did you decide to look into and why? And then how did you go about gathering the information? And is it enough? Is it high resolution enough in your mind from the sources that you had available to form? And I hope you'll tell us about any, maybe you're keeping personal stuff out of it because you're just going purely on the information. But what did that tell you? So start with one of the individuals, Sanjana Hutatua.
Yeah, so Sanjana Hutatua, well, I guess to give it back, to go back a wee bit and give some background, I was, so I did some intelligence work in anti-human trafficking. And so I was helping to set up sort of an intelligence capability. And so that gave me some more in-depth research skills looking at collecting information around that and evaluating things like child sexual exploitation, things like that. Just some not very nice stuff. No. But I started to develop some sort of capability and research skills. And I was very good at it. I was also very good at the research side from my university days as well, sort of writing scientific reports and things like that. And so sort of bringing these things together, when COVID-19 kicked off, I could see, and even prior to COVID-19, to be honest, I could see sort of the political weaponization of especially sort of the media. Now not necessarily just in New Zealand, but right across the Western world. And I thought, what are the drivers of this? Because it seems to be coming quite tribal.
Yes, I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I started at that point and I thought, what are the drivers of sort of this tribal sort of form of politics that are happening? You've got, and generally it was along the lines of, you had a whole group of sort of mismatched people with all different ideas and backgrounds, and they were being considered as being the far right. And then you had on the other side, I guess, the people that were considered the progressives, and they were essentially very much in tune with each other. Right. And so I just started to look into, well, what was the drivers behind that, and how was this sort of, what was the ideology driving this? And then when the pandemic hit, that was sort of like escalated very quickly, the sort of two different sides, so to speak. And so then throughout the pandemic, I sort of started covering some of the protests and things like that from an intelligence perspective, just capturing the size of the crowds, things like that, because I was just interested in seeing sort of how big the movement was, and who was going, that type of thing, as opposed to, you know, who what on the sort of the so-called progressive side. Then I sort of realized that this side wasn't getting fair coverage in the news, And so I decided to join then with Chantelle Baker and her partner, who were running around filming as well. And so we teamed up, and then we sort of quickly noticed that, yes, censorship was occurring. And that's when I said, right, well, I'm going to do the investigative piece, and I'm going to start digging in with the Official Information Act and actually working out what's going on behind here and whether this is sort of driven from within the government itself. And so that's when I started doing the OIAs and quickly realized that the Disinformation Project were sort of a central player in shaping a narrative within New Zealand. And that was by going on news and producing their reports for the government, where these reports would get circulated throughout the government and on mainstream news. And they would set sort of a narrative that was extremely politically biased and fitted that sort of picture that I'd been already observing within sort of, you know, the last 10 years. So that led me to sort of dig into that, to the Disinformation Project.
And that's where he comes in. And of course, the other name is Kate Hannah. That's where she comes in. We'll get to her shortly. So did you know about this, any of these people beforehand? We probably heard the names maybe. Did you have any idea, you know, the backstory that they had? What did you find? Let's start with Sinjana.
No, so prior to the Disinformation Project sort of popping on the scene, like I didn't know who they were. And it wasn't really until I found the Official Information Act requests, some initial ones, and just saw what they were doing on mainstream news that I actually sort of started to dig in. And then I started mapping out with a sort of network map, who was involved within the government level and what other organizations were involved in the censorship, and also determining what their role was, and that was in sort of setting a narrative and also censorship. So more recently, I've got sort of a lot more evidence to show their active involvement in censorship. But initially it was more about framing a narrative, and then that narrative would be picked up by the rest of government as a basis by which they would then set policy and operating procedure. And I guess even Sanjana himself quite nicely puts that. He says in one of the videos he's shot of himself in Sri Lanka, that a lack of information drives a narrative or a information landscape of myth and fiction, and that myth and fiction gets picked up by the government as their operating sort of procedure and for setting their policy.
So what's his background? You mentioned Sri Lanka. Obviously, you can tell by the name that they're from there, but... So how did he end? Do we know how he got to here and being on TV news and being someone?
Yeah.
And I think you make the point that he's quite an eloquent speaker. He strings together the words quite well. And I guess the media likes that and will engage with that. So what's his background?
Yeah. So when I started looking into the Disinformation Project, I sort of just looked at the main characters that you see on TV. And so that was Kate Hannah and Sanjana Hatutua. Now, it's interesting, Sanjana's background. So it looks to me like he's come here for his PhD at the University of Otago. And that is centering around sort of social media analysis. But interestingly, what he then sort of got picked up by this Disinformation Project run out of Te Punaha Matatini. And that project was essentially initiated at the request of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. So we've got that in an OIA.
Say that again.
So the Disinformation Project was initiated at the request of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. It looks to me like they were already working with Te Punaha Matatini on a lot of their COVID-19 modelling. their sort of intervention modeling.
So what does that say? So how is the chain of command go there? Is it top down, or do they, the Department of Prime Minister, suddenly realize these people existed and thought they were really smart and, hey, we can engage them? Or were they, did it go the other way, where, you know, they actually thought, or did some sort of deal with them, thought that we have similar ends to meet here, let's get together, and these guys look like they can get our message out. How do you think that worked?
It looked more like, from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet side, they were working closely with Te Pūnaha Matatini already, and they what they wanted to do was they wanted to make sure that there was no sort of oppositional voices that would, I guess in some ways, hinder their policy, hinder their COVID-19 policy or their interventions. And so then they set up the, or they approached Te Pūnaha Matatini and said, you know, can you set this up?
They must have been confident, though, to do that. They must have thought, well, these people will find this acceptable. Yeah, these are.
I think the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, I think she had quite close ties already with Te Pūnaha Matatini. I think they won the Prime Minister's award 1 year or
of course
something like that. So they're very much and they're very much often sort of mainstream media's go-to people as well. So you know, they had very close ties with that government, and also close ties with the media already. And so it just became probably the first port of call, really, to go to them and say, can you set up something that's going to evaluate mis- and disinformation within New Zealand?
And evaluate it genuinely to know what was, I hate those words, misinformation, disinformation, or to set up information in a way where what we disagree with can be classed as one thing. What we want to promote, the narrative, whatever you want to call it, will be accepted as something the opposite from that.
Yes, I think so. Because if you were, I mean, from my sort of scientific study, I would suggest that if you were going to study mis- and disinformation within New Zealand, that you would study it right across an entire spectrum. But it seems to me that they're constantly just focusing on one end of that spectrum. So, for instance, they're really focused on misogyny. Well, what about misandry, which would be at the other end, which would be sort of the hate of men? Now, is there any of that around? Not the hate of men, the hate of sort of women hating men. So misogyny would sort of be, you know, what they would call a toxic masculine sort of approach and really degrading men and things like that. But do we see anything from the other side? Now being a spectrum, I would say that yes, you would see outliers on both sides. Typically, most phenomena in a distribution will probably fall in sort of a normal distribution, where you'll have sort of a mainstream section in the middle, and then out to the fringes, it gets pretty small, but there might be some pretty vile stuff out there, but that's definitely not mainstream. So I would have expected that if you were going to do a study like that, that you would at least identify whatever was out on both of those fringes. But it seems that they really focus on sort of one of those fringes, which happens when you look at their own sort of ideology. It happens to be at the other side to where their fringe is, if that makes sense.
It does. And the, okay, so I mentioned this chap's name. So he's come to New Zealand. He's gone to Otago University, as you mentioned. And now he's, what, part of the disinformation project. I mean, how do you get into that club?
I would say it's probably an ideological club. To me, it looks very ideologically driven. If you look at a lot of their reports, and not only just the Disinformation Project, but even Te Pūnaha Matatini more broadly, they are sort of what you would call woke or critical theorist aligned in a lot of their ideology. So they're very much worried about sort of inequity and power structures and things like that. Now, some of that might be valid. So I'm not sort of ruling it out and saying that there are no inequalities and things we should look into. But it seems that, yes, they are very much focused on that sort of level from or those sort of topics, but through this lens of sort of critical theory or wokeness. So they're sort of very woke. So you probably get into that field by sort of sharing or that sort of club, so to speak, by sharing those views. I would say if you didn't really buy into the sort of class struggle way of looking at the world, then you probably wouldn't last very long there.
I'm talking with Phil Shaw of Operation People.
In some of the clips I've seen of him over the time, he seems very confident about what he says, extremely confident.
Yeah, very much. He's a very good speaker. Like, I'll definitely give him that. Like, he's very eloquent, very, very well spoken. And I think sometimes maybe to his detriment, because he does seem to sensationalize things probably too much.
Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, even there was a time that he was on, I think it was like the AM show or something like that, and he compared the sort of mis and disinformation landscape to the Christchurch earthquake. And you could tell that the reporter was not that impressed with that parallel. And she sort of pushed back on it a wee bit. And you can tell visibly from the body language that she was not that impressed. So she sort of pushed back on it, and you know, he was taken back that he was getting pushback from the media.
Not used to it, eh?
not used to it, I don't think. But he did double down in the end. He did double down and say, well, you know, mis and disinformation is you know, I don't want to get it wrong, but I think he was implying that it does have sort of consequences where it is essentially killing people. Now, that might have been, he might have sort of determined that was through by minimizing public health policy, if that makes sense, because that may have an effect in a pandemic of having undesired outcomes. However, I guess when you look at the sort of mis and disinformation, it probably turns out now with the latest sort of research and study coming out around the whole pandemic that, you know, they got it wrong on masks, the Mis and Disinformation Project, or, you know, they got it wrong on masks. Even now, I think in some of these countries like the UK, they're starting to question sort of the effect that the vaccine has on pericarditis and things like that. So that they are actually starting to question, well, you know, in some age groups, is this actually a intervention that's less beneficial than not having the intervention? So
let me get this right. So the Disinformation Project, working with the Prime Minister's office to form and or create and form narratives that then were picked up by the media and basically smacking down anyone else that had another point of view, were, as it turned out, all wrong.
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases now, I think, so that latest Cochrane review is coming out to say that, you know, that masks don't actually work for viruses that are around the size of coronavirus and influenza viruses. Now, they're only about, I think they're about 180 nanometers in diameter. And, you know, I think the pore size is larger than that, which means they just essentially fly through.
So they made it up.
Well, I think the science was heavily politicized from what was going on in the United States. If we look back there, you'll see that because Donald Trump was in at the time, and you'll see that anything he said, the media and that sort of the so-called progressive side had a sort of knee-jerk reaction and needed to run the other way to essentially paint him like he was Hitler.
And Trump derangement syndrome.
Yeah. Trump derangement syndrome is probably a very real thing.
PDS.
Yes. And so essentially that's sort of one thing that I noticed within the pandemic was, you know, like the COVID-19 origins. I think Trump said he started calling it the China virus. Well, they didn't like that. However, like strains later, they could call it the Brazilian strain or the South African strain with no problems without being xenophobic. So there was things, if Trump said it, they went the
other way. This is really interesting. It all centers around Trump then, doesn't it, in a way? And the ironic thing, the weird thing is, he was the one who promoted Operation Warp Speed, which had these things delivered in no time flat. Yeah. That's turning out to be a nightmare, potentially. Yeah. Yet they were happy to go with that part of the Trump action, which was probably the most major part. Yeah. None of this makes sense, mate.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, I guess that's the problem when you just build a narrative that's in fiction. You know, it doesn't make sense. It will not stand the test of time.
This chap, how old is he?
I'm not sure actually. Haven't pinned down his age, but ballpark, I would say probably in his sort of late 30s, early 40s.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So is he still out there saying things? I haven't seen anything recently from this chap. Is he sort of staying a bit under the radar because he realizes now?
No, I guess I only put out my report just this week. So it'll be interesting to see. I think Kate Hanna did come on over the sort of whole climate change thing that's just happened recently with that.
That's safe ground for her, isn't it? That's safe ground because there's a lot of people who believe that.
Yeah.
And they're entitled to believe anything they want. And maybe have only, again, had the filter of the mainstream media and the constant words of experts and atmospheric rivers and, you know, all this climate crisis, et cetera. I think Chantel mentioned that she went along to one of Kate Hanna's presentations.
Were you there as well? Yes, I attended. I was sitting right beside.
What was that like?
It was interesting. The research that she presented, I mean, coming from a scientific discipline, medical laboratory science, to me it was shoddy at best. It was fluff. You know, it was essentially a propaganda piece. There was no real graphs. There was nothing really to show anything visually other than some relatively artistic looking diagrams. And
they love their graphics.
Yeah. And I mean, even the language was relatively sensationalized and predictable. You know, she talked about all the things that you would expect sort of that the woke person to talk about. What was probably more interesting to me was her response at the question time. Now, Chantel had a bit of a back and forth with her. We sat right in the front row and Chantel had a cap and a mask on just to sort of keep it a surprise till the end, because we did want to give her a fair shot to convey her information in the talk. We didn't want to sit right in the front row and have her know that Chantel was right there, because we thought, yeah, well, that'll put unfair pressure on her and she won't be able to deliver her talk. And yeah, I'm definitely of the opinion that, hey, the more people talk, the better, because information's going to get out there and people can evaluate it themselves. Kiwis are smart enough to do that. And so, yeah, the more information, the better. So we did want to make sure that she could have her say before we would let her know or put the pressure on that she knew that we were there. So, yeah, at the end, at the question time, no one really was sort of offering a question. So Chantel,
that's interesting. Sorry to jump in. Well, they were just all sitting there.
You do sort of often get that, don't you, at the end of a talk or something, that it is always a little bit of an awkward silence until the first person's sort of bold enough to put their hand up. And it might depend on the talk, but yeah, it was pretty quiet. And then Chantel sort of, I guess, realized that no one was really asking a question. So she took her hat and mask off and said, hey, well, I'm Chantel Baker.
Surprise.
Yeah. That's
it's
right.
A great reveal.
Yeah. So she sort of had a bit of a back and forth.
What was her reaction when she realized it was Chantel? It must have got her.
Yeah. And a hard one to describe. I think she was a little bit shocked and probably a little bit worried at the same time.
Flustered. Flustered.
Flustered, yeah. Probably also a little bit contemptuous as well. She didn't look that impressed that Chantel was there.
So there's a hubris and arrogance that goes with this.
I think there would be. There would be a little bit. And Chantel's question that she was, or conversation she was having, was around how do you classify intent? Because disinformation is information spread with the intent to cause harm. So that means that if the Disinformation Project have classified her as being part of the American imported disinformation dozen, then surely she's determined that Chantel's intent is to cause harm to people in the population. Well, that is absolutely false, because there is no intent to cause harm. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's the intent to just keep people informed, which was probably the same intent that Sanjana had in Sri Lanka when he was doing his citizen journalism over there. The intent was to have another side, another perspective of information to allow people to be informed. And it turns out that Chantel was right on a few of those things.
I'm just thinking that the meaning of disinformation, casting someone like Chantel as a spouter of disinformation that could get people harmed.
Yeah,
that's actually quite a serious thing to publicly declare about someone. Very serious, actually.
Yes.
And reckless, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, like, typically you would see disinformation campaigns in like a war, right? Because in a war, you're actually inflicting damage on your opposition, on your enemy.
Part of the fight.
It's part of the fight. So you have a disinformation campaign, perhaps hoping that the enemy might walk right into an ambush.
Yeah, and people are killed. Yeah.
And people are killed. So you're giving information out that's false, knowing that it's going to harm people. So that would be probably a good example of disinformation. You try and in some way convey to the enemy that you're going to be somewhere where you're not, and you're going to walk them right into an ambush. So that would be sort of a classic military example of disinformation. Misinformation is information that's spread generally that's wrong, that's untrue, that's generally without any intent to cause harm. And that would be just, it's a mistake. You've made a mistake. You've spread something that you thought was true in the moment, and it turns out that actually you were wrong. However, you spread it anyway. So an example of that might be the mask. The mask.
That's misinformation.
That's misinformation, because now it turns out that actually masks didn't work at all for COVID-19. Yeah.
But no one's died from that we know of.
No, exactly. And the intent that they would have spread that initially was good intent.
Yeah.
So they weren't hoping that a whole lot of people would put masks on and die. No. They were hoping that these masks were actually going to help reduce the transmission of the virus from person to person, thereby reducing the toll on the healthcare system. The good intent, however, turns out bad information.
But the intent is lacking. But to cast someone as a misinformation spreader is basically saying that you are there to do people potentially physical harm.
Now another example of this as well, and this pertains exactly to Chantel, and her and her partner went over and they were getting some interviews from Ukraine, from on the Ukrainian side. Now, what happened in the background there was a bunch of Twitter trolls and political opposition, I guess you would say, got on and started to put Twitter posts on and things, trying to raise attention to the SBU, which is the Ukrainian intelligence, that they were sort of Kremlin-backed or Kremlin spies or that nature. Now, that would be... What was the intent there? I don't want to read into it, but I can't help
reading something into that.
Yeah. What's the intent there? Because what are the ramifications? And I've got a special forces background, so maybe I can speak to this.
I've got that filter on too. I'm considering your background and hearing this.
Yeah. So what are the implications? I mean, yes, she might not have been shot, but they might have been picked up. They might have been interrogated for hours on end as until that they could find out whether they were indeed backed by the Kremlin, which we are not. That is...
Yeah, but you don't know, do you? Because we're supporting Ukraine officially. Yeah. You don't know what the back channels are. I mean, I think the ambassador for Ukraine is Australian-based. But, you know, how do you know that information's... Because to be considered in the category of misinformationist or whatever the word is, or disinformationist, sorry, anyway, it's dangerous, right? It's dangerous. You don't know if you've already been categorized like that in your own country by official institutions and the Prime Minister's Department. I mean, what is being said to the Ukrainians?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And hey, it turns out that one of the organizations Sanjana's on the executive for actually works with the Russian government, according to their declaration. So if anyone has links to the Kremlin, it would happen to be Sanjana Hatatua.
You can't make this stuff up.
So if you go and check out the mission on ICT for Peace, I think it's .org, which is an organization there. You'll see his name on there, but he's been part of setting that up over in Sri Lanka. They actually declare that they work with the Russian government on there. So,
It's all over the show.
Hey, there's some links there.
It must have been an interesting little journey uncovering these things. Here's an obvious question: how much do these people get paid? Do we know? Did you see what sort of salary bracket? Because quite often, I think you know the remuneration can speak to the motivation. And I'm just wondering how well looked after, and where does the funding come from? Does it come from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet?
So from what I can tell from Official Information Acts, the Tertiary Education Commission has funded Te Punaha Matatini. Now, given that they used to sit under them, they don't anymore. They've gone private.
Now, why would they have gone private?
My suspicion. Now this is only sort of a hypothesis.
Got to ask the question, though.
Yeah. So, yeah, my suspicion as to why they went private was to avoid the Official Information Act because...
Right.
Te Punaha Matatini sits under University of Auckland. They sit under Te Punaha Matatini. University of Auckland is a public institution and is subject to the Official Information Act. And now we got reports that were produced by the Disinformation Project under contract directly to the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet once they went private. So after they'd come out of being a government institution, and they went private. They contracted directly to the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. Now that was for about $27,000 ish, rounding that, for three reports. But even in the top of those reports, on the cover page, it has a wee remark there that says essentially, if this is going to be requested under the Official Information Act, make sure that they contact the Disinformation Project first to clarify it with them. So they were very aware that they were going to be asked for information under the Official Information Act.
Hmm.
And so that would give me some weighting to my hypothesis that perhaps that is the driving factor for why they actually got out from being within a government organization.
And if that's the case, again, another tell as to where they sit in the scheme of things. Right?
Yeah, and I guess another piece of evidence to sort of suggest that as well would be to go back to that Labor MP. Remember, he came out, he was a doctor, I think. He came out and sort of...
The Hamilton chap.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And he was kind of somewhat whistleblowing the fact that they... were coaching people how to get around the Official Information Act and things. Now, I would say a lot of that coaching would have been just get on the phone and have a conversation. Don't do anything, you know, in text or email where there's a paper trail, and jump on a Zoom meeting or a Microsoft Teams. They often use those, and you'll recover the evidence of those meetings, but none of the content, unfortunately. If I was going to push for legislation around that, I would get all of those meetings recorded and stored within government somewhere so that there is a record, because they often don't have transcripts either actually for those meetings. So
they must be loving that.
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay, so, wow, what a story. I'm just wondering where this leaves us at this stage of the game. Seems like a bit of a game, though it's a very serious one. So we've got the Disinformation Project, not subject to interrogation by OIA now, with very close connections. And what, is there any reason to believe that with the change of Prime Minister that anything has changed in the sort of the architecture of this? I mean, Chris Hipkins was pretty close into the whole thing, wasn't he? I mean, there'd be no reason to believe, would there, to, that anything's really changed there?
Yeah, I think he would have been very close into the COVID-19, you know, the whole COVID-19 policy. Yep. And they were advising on that. So he would have definitely known what was going on. Whether he's carried on now and carried on those relationships, I'm not sure. But, hey, I will be digging. I will be looking for that information. So I can't say whether he has sort of kept them on contracting them.
I'll reframe it this way. Are we seeing evidence in the way information is being presented right now, comparing it with, you know, what we've been seeing, that anything has changed?
So I don't think so, because they're still coming on national TV. They're still spinning the narrative that way. But I haven't seen any sort of government contracts yet. But in saying that, I haven't asked yet. So I will be asking at some point to see any contracts or even research grants, because that's another way that they can be funded. They can be funded by any number of research grants from, say, MBIE. I think in 2021, I think they received a research grant from them, from MBIE. And yeah, so research grants may be another way to fund that organization as well.
You think they really believe, okay, we've talked about two here, but there'll be more. Do you think they really believe in what they're doing, or is it just a kind of massive ego trip where people are listening to you, you have some power and some say, you're talking to the most powerful people in the land, all that? Yeah. Or are they really down in their rabbit hole? Sorry to use that term.
Yeah, I think it's a good term to use, because I think it's probably all of the above. So I think there's an element of it's their people in power. It's a tool that they're using to sort of set the narrative and maintain that power. They view, if they're that embedded into the critical theory and the woke stuff, then they do view everything as a power struggle. And so they're going to do everything they can to sort of maintain their position in that.
So the ends justify the means.
I think so. Now evidence for that as well would be Sanjana's role in Sri Lanka was very much the opposite. So in Sri Lanka, his people were not in power and he was a citizen journalist. So he funded a website called Ground Views. And that was in 2006. And it's very clear from his writing that he does not like the Rajapaksa family, who had the majority of power for a number of years in Sri Lanka, quite a few years. They're actually responsible for ending the civil war between the LTTE and the Sri Lankan forces. That's questionable. Yeah.
That was a brutal war too, wasn't it?
That was a brutal war, and the way it ended, I think, was potentially extremely brutal and perhaps even illegal from what the government did. So his work in Sri Lanka was probably very good and very necessary, because he was essentially doing what we at Operation People are doing, but over there in Sri Lanka. So he'd built a website. He was doing citizen journalism, investigating, putting information out in the public square, but countering the narratives of mainstream media. Now, some of these words are his. He actually says that. You just need to go and have a look at what the Sanjana in Sri Lanka was like. Go and have a look at Ground Views. But very much didn't like the government that was in power, the Rajapaksa family, which was a bit of a political dynasty. And he even, in some of his writings for Ground Views, Sanjana even likens, I think it was Gotabaya Rajapaksa, to Donald Trump. So he
Here we go.
So he very much, again, fits that sort of Trump derangement syndrome type character, and drew those parallels to his own president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, in an article sort of saying, like Trump, he's like this, and like Trump, he's like this, and very critical of his government. Now, I'm not going to weigh in on whether that was warranted or valid or anything like that. The reality is, over there, he was the complete opposite to what he is here. Over there, he was citizen journalism, fighting against mainstream media narrative, fighting against the government, fighting against government censorship of journalism. And over here, he's part of the machine that is working very close, if not directly, for government. He's spinning the narrative on mainstream media, and he's part of the censorship machine. So there's a Official Information Act document that we've got, and unfortunately, the text under the heading is redacted, but the heading talks about, indicates that they are involved in sort of active censorship. Talks about the Disinformation Project's sort of role in censoring information, or reporting of information.
In the time we've got left, because we've been chatting quite a while, when you say censorship, what does that mean? What form does that take?
So censoring, from what I've seen, mainly through Official Information Acts, is there's a document that talks about deamplification, post-deletion, and takedowns of social media accounts and posts. So it looks like they are working alongside big tech to take down information they don't like. Now, I can't really get the information that they've requested to be taken down. I've got a document from CERT New Zealand, which has a whole lot of complaints made to them that they passed on to another organization called the Disinformation Assessment and Response Team that sat within.
Do they wear capes?
Yeah. Well, there's only three of them, I think, in that team. So these teams are quite small, but probably have quite an impact. That the DART team within Ministry of Health, they had a go at censoring us, Operation People and Chantel. So, and we've got the email document record. So they would forward information onto NetSafe, who has function under the harmful. Or has a government function under the Harmful Digital Communications Act, and their role would be to take out things like child pornography and things like that. Objectionable material. That is, and I've worked in the field of investigating child sexual exploitation and things like that. It is not nice, and it is not good. It does need to be taken out and stomped down. But when you start to blur those lines and you start to take out people more on a political policy basis around things like co-governance and three waters, things like the COVID-19
where does it end? Where does it end?
Yeah, and I mean conservative ideals around family structure. To me, that is almost a mainstream sort of idea within New Zealand. So, yes, okay, so, not all so, of us.
Say that again.
So conservative ideals around family structure is what they considered a broader threat.
What?
In terms of, in light of information censorship, in light of censoring information along the lines of COVID-19 pandemic, what they would class as mis and disinformation, they saw broader threats as being, for example, conservative ideals around family structure. Now, most New Zealand families probably maintain that structure. Now, it's not always going to be the case. There's always exceptions to the rule. But as a generalization, probably most families in New Zealand probably align somewhat with that structure. And perhaps ideally would prefer that structure, although...
Well, it's worked pretty well for a long time, is my view of it, yeah.
Yeah, so...
And that was during COVID, did you say?
Yeah, so that was...
Is that all about families mixing, MIQ, all those, you know, going to see Nana at the rest home? I mean...
No, not necessarily. No, it's more about the ideology, political ideology, because it's paired with things like anti-Māori sentiment. Now, I would, looking at some of the disinformation reports, I would take that to be actually just being against co-governance, where you have sort of unelected people in positions of power.
Not a racist attitude, but, no, you know, but, a democracy.
Yeah.
A question of democracy.
Yeah. A question of democracy, very much. And if you look at the type of people that are making these arguments, and they are the type of people that were at the protest, you know, and Kate Hannah described them well in one of her reports. They are a group of people that were there for a diverse range of ideas. So there was no unified idea. There was no unified message. This is what the media was telling us as well. It was disorganized, but they were rallied around one concept. What was that? Freedom. So that, to me, indicates that was a massive group of what you would class as libertarians. They were concerned with one thing, freedom. Everything else they disagreed on. That to me would suggest that there was a whole lot of groups there with their own ideas on things, and they, you know, rallied around that one issue, which was freedom. That's a group of libertarians. If you look up the definition of a libertarian, that's their number one value is freedom. Everything else comes secondary to that. So you had people from all different religions. You had people from different ethnicities.
Wasn't it wonderful?
It was. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've with my military background, you know, I've worked in a very sort of multicultural environment, and that I enjoyed that about the military. I enjoyed going over to East Timor and spending 6 months there and sort of interacting with the local culture. I've been to Norway, to Malaysia, and interacted with those cultures. It's and Thailand as well. It's really cool getting to see these, you know, these other cultures, and to work in that environment as well. And being at that protest, covering it with the camera, it was like being back in the military, but in the sense of that multicultural feeling and sentiment, but at the next level, it was quite nice to see so many different sort of cultures and ideas coming together in such a harmonious way, under that umbrella of sort of freedom.
And they view those people with those ideals as a threat.
Yeah. Now I would suggest that's a threat to their political ideology.
Right, but nonetheless a threat.
Complete opposite. It's antithetical to their ideology, which is essentially collectivism.
So and control.
And control, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's coming under this one idea. And you can see that within their ideology. There is sort of, I mean, even that latest climate change MP, you know, she was brought into line, into the party line, as the Communist Party would have. Yeah. That in some respects is probably an indication of a cultural class struggle. Wow. She was made to come out publicly and
struggle session.
That's right.
Public. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's been a few of those. So look up the Andrew Judd interview. That was a cultural struggle session. I don't know if you've seen that interview.
No, I haven't seen that. But
I'll do a video on that at some point. But he essentially sort of in line with the sort of woke ideology, he essentially comes on air. He denounces or he apologized for being a racist, and he then denounces essentially his entire culture.
Wow.
And it's... Yes, if you're a racist, fair enough. Maybe you want to go and apologize for it.
Yeah.
That's fair enough. But to denounce your entire culture, that's actually going more into a cultural struggle.
Yeah, it's like
a struggle
sort of
position.
Huge self-loathing complex.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now it's interesting. There's an academic, Robert J. Lifton. He's very interesting to sort of go and have a listen to some of his lectures. He talks about sort of the Chinese thought reform, and he studied that back in sort of, I think, around the throughout the Chinese Cultural Revolution time. Now, he's got some interesting bullet points there, or concepts that he sort of derived from seeing victims of the Chinese thought reform. And he's very interesting to sort of have a listen to in light of what's happening culturally within the world at the moment.
What an interesting interview, chat, whatever you want to call it. It's just fascinating, Phil, to hear what you've told us. And I think it really informs people a lot more. It sort of brings it into, again, into focus. Everything's a bit fuzzy. That brings a lot of things into focus and a huge amount to think about. And I would kind of say worry about a bit too. Do you think?
Yeah, yes, I think so. But I think things are changing because people are talking, and that's exactly what needs to happen. People just need to keep talking about all of these issues, about what they're seeing. And they just need to be bold enough to just stand up and speak out and say, you know, we're not going to get bullied into one line of thought. We're actually going to be independent thinkers. We're going to think for ourselves, and we're going to be aware of what's going on in society. And, you know, we're going to talk to our neighbours and things like that. I think that's the best thing you can do, is just keep talking, keep looking at different perspectives, and just weigh those perspectives from what you observe in society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, the trust erodes though, doesn't it? You can't help that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the problem.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think that's why these sort of ideologies become very totalitarian and very dominating. I mean, even with the Posey Parker stuff, you see sort of a group of people now threatening to go up and, you know, and stomp on that.
It's as if they're possessed. Yeah. You know, it's more than just enthusiasm. It's sort of a possession.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's almost cult-like. You know,
It is.
You can't depart from the party line, and if you do, you must be beaten back into submission
or destroyed.
Or destroyed. And any opposing ideals are a threat. So,
like freedom. I mean,
like freedom, because that is antithetical, right? To control, to wanting.
But
to
freedom it. For them, freedom for the people running it. This is the thing.
Yeah. Well, that is ironically there's a concept called repressive tolerance. An academic called Herbert Marcuse came up with this idea, which is tolerance is accepted for anything that advances the objectives of the ideals of the movement. But anything outside that's going to hinder that is to be repressed. So there's an idea of sort of repressive tolerance. So everything, I mean, because it's come out of academia, they've written about this all over the place. So it's, you know, it's not that hard to find the information. It's not hidden. It's just not really known in the public circles yet. But it is, you know, people are sort of becoming more aware of what's the ideology driving a lot of this.
And you've got to be like a dog with a bone. You've just got to go at it and drill down. And as you say, the information's there. And thankfully, someone like yourself and the skills you've got has been doing that on our behalf, as it turns out now, because we know a lot more about it. Again, thanks for your time. Keep up the good work, and all the best for Operation People.
Yeah, no, Dan, thank you very much for having me, and all the best with Reality Check Radio.
RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.